This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Neuroscientists are discovering more and more about how our brains work and why we act as we do. But those advances in neuroscience, those answers they come up with, are presenting some big questions in another field. Some suggest the progress in neuroscience could radically transform our legal system. Indeed, neuroscientific evidence is already making its way from the research labs into courtrooms, for instance, in trying to determine what kind of punishment some defendants should receive. What happens at a cellular level could well help keep a defendant out of a prison cell. Law professor Jeffrey Rosen says all this progress will force us to re-examine core ideas about justice and law. It could change, he says, how we determine guilt and responsibility, and even how we pick juries. He raises the prospect of a brain scan to detect bias. Jeffrey Rosen spoke about all of this in a July speech at the Aspen Ideas Festival, and it's that speech we'll hear today on Word for Word. The Aspen Ideas Festival is a week-long series of talks and conversations among leaders in politics, science, education, business, and the arts. Jeffrey Rosen is a law professor at George Washington University and the legal affairs editor at The New Republic, a bimonthly magazine of politics and culture. And here he is, Jeffrey Rosen, on July 7th at the Aspen Ideas Festival, giving his presentation, The Brain on the Stand.
I have to say that the topic I want to talk to you about this morning, how neuroscience is transforming the law, is one of the most fascinating I've ever come across as a journalist. I stumbled upon it unexpectedly. Like many of these things, it came about as a series of conversations with friends. I just was looking for the next big thing in law and started calling around my smart friends and asked them what they thought the next wave was going to be. And several of them said, it's this new field that some are calling neurolaw. In particular, there was one friend, Carter Sneed, who worked for President Bush's Council on Bioethics, which is not a group that you would think would be sympathetic to some of the ideas in this movement. But he said, this is transforming death penalty cases. It's becoming almost de rigueur anytime there's a capital conviction to introduce some neuroscience defense and to say basically the defendant's brain made him do it. He was unable to control his actions because of a brain defect. And under the very relaxed standards for sentencing, the evidence usually comes in. It doesn't always succeed. Remember that crazy case involving the Woman's Wear Daily reporter who had a crush on his former girlfriend? He kind of kidnapped her, tied her up, put on her Manola Blahniks, that was a very important part of the fetish, and then abused her in all sorts of awful ways. She sued, he was tried, he got the best neuroscientist money could buy to say his brain made him do it. He was unable to control himself because his amygdala, which is the region of the brain responsible for emotion, had an organic defect and therefore was overwhelming his dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is the area more responsible for rational deliberation. Now, as it happened, the jury completely did not buy this defense. It took them only 4 hours to deliberate and to convict him without any question at all. So that suggests that although this evidence is being admitted, it's not always being found convincing. But more and more, this is transforming different areas of the law. And what I want to do is talk to you this morning about three broad areas in particular, which could be radically transformed by neuroscience over the next decades. The first involves questions of guilt and responsibility, what we mean when we think about holding people responsible for their actions. The second involves lie detection and the detection of hidden bias. And the third, and to me almost the creepiest and most interesting, is the prediction of future behavior. Is it possible to really identify people's predisposition to commit future acts and to hold them responsible for that? So these are three awfully interesting areas. And then I want to talk with you during our conversation about who will resolve the vexing philosophical and legal and moral questions that this neuroscience presents. Will it be the courts? Should we expect judges to solve these problems for us? Or ultimately, as I want to argue, will we as a society have to debate and resolve these questions ourselves. One more vignette about how I got interested in the subject. A law school classmate of mine, Owen Jones, who teaches at Vanderbilt, turns out to be one of the most enthusiastic proponents of the transformative potential of neurolaw. And he's trying to turn Vanderbilt University, where he teaches law, into the Los Alamos of neurolaw. The university has gotten a $27 million new neuroimaging center, and Jones wants to integrate that with the law school to look at the way that the law could be transformed by neuroscience. So he said, come on out. You'll see this fancy new system, and you will be Exhibit A in this new experiment we're conducting about harm and punishment, as we called it. How do people assign punishments? He said, this is just going to be phenomenal because it could change the way we select jurors. We'll put them under the fMRI machine, find out how harshly they're likely to punish, and then make a decision about what sort of balance between emotion and punitive reason we want. A defense lawyer in an insider trading case might want a really rational, deliberative person, whereas if you have some sort of entrapment case, you might want a greater bit of emotion. So he says, come into the fMRI and we'll see how you do. So I went down there. Many of you, I'm sure, have had MRI scans, but this experiment was a little bit different because you had to stay in there a really long time. This was one of these three Tesla machines, not the most powerful. Vanderbilt has a 7 Tesla down in the basement, which is the most powerful in the world. But the 3 Tesla machine looks like a regular MRI machine. You go in there, it had to take off all metal. There was a little dry cleaning tag and off with a belt and that sort of thing. And then the trick was to remain really, really still for 45 minutes, not moving an eyebrow. Instantly, I became convinced this is not ready to be used in airports to detect terrorists. You have to really want to do it. So you're completely still, it's black, and on a screen they're flashing all of these very emotionally engaging punishment scenarios, such as Jim wants to kill his father for insurance money. He decides to electrocute him by short-circuiting a power saw at home. He fails, but the father is paralyzed. What punishment would you assign to Jim? And I had to choose a number between 0 and 9. So this is going on for 45 minutes, a series of increasingly gothic crimes. I'm getting very exercised, but you know, trying to remain totally still. And then finally, after 45 minutes of this intense activity, stumble out into the light. I come back the next morning to find out how my brain had done, because he had his grad students up all night looking at my brain, which was very flattering for me, although dull for them, I'm sure. And I came in and they were just beaming so broadly. They said, you are one of the best subjects we've had because you were completely still, you didn't move at all, and you're the harshest punisher we've ever had. I didn't even know this about me. I thought I was a cuddly and mild type of fellow of the most benign disposition. But it turned out I basically wanted to fry even the jaywalkers. And I could watch my brain activating as the punishment scenarios are coming along. You see these little, it's really very phrenological, these little dots moving, which are my eyes watching the scenarios. And then you could see the activation for my amygdala, which is the emotional region of the brain, getting all excited. And then the prefrontal cortex activating as well in response to these scenarios. Now, their hypothesis was, when they started the experiment, that the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex would struggle against each other. Basically, you'd have the emotional impulse, which would be literally restrained and suppressed in some cases by the rational regions of the brain in cases where there was a harm but no intentional harm or no legal liability. If something had been accidental or negligent, you wouldn't actually want to assign the same punishment as for first-degree murder, and they thought that maybe you'd see the two regions of the brain interacting in this way. That turned out not to be the case. In fact, the prefrontal cortex activation was the most reliable indication of the degree of punishment that you would assign, regardless of the amygdala activity. And they didn't quite know what to make of this. First of all, it was a very preliminary response. They thought maybe it would change when there were more subjects. But even with this preliminary finding, they said this would still be very useful for defense lawyers and prosecutors, because if you could scan people, you could predict pretty closely what kind of punishments they were likely to assign based on their prefrontal cortex activity, regardless of what the amygdala said. For me, one of the other very interesting things was to discover that there's a region of the brain called the worry wart region, which obsesses about a decision after it's made it. So I could watch myself looking at the punishment scenarios, and then after I'd press the button to assign a punishment, for several milliseconds afterward, this huge activation for the worry wart part, obsessively and neurotically wondering whether I'd made the right decision. And as it happens, I do have a rather obsessive side when it comes to making decisions. I do tend to second guess decisions after they're made, at least certain kinds, and there was the worry wart section activating heavily. So that was very interesting. Indeed. So that was my trip to Vanderbilt, and Jones and his colleagues are just bubbling over with enthusiasm about the potential of this new technology to transform the legal system. But are they too enthusiastic? Are they too heedless of the costs of some of these technologies? And should we think more soberly about what some of those costs are as we start down into this brave new world? Now I do want to talk to you about these three broad areas: guilt and responsibility, lying and the detection of hidden bias, and finally that prediction of future dangerousness that I find so interesting. So what about guilt and responsibility? Why is it that the most enthusiastic proponents of this technology say that it poses a challenge to the central conception of the human person in the Anglo-American legal system? Traditionally, English and American law have generally held people responsibility for their actions unless they act under duress, for example, with a gun to your head, do it or else, or if they behave under some serious defect of rationality. The most famous is the insanity defense outlined in the Monauton case in 1842 in Britain involving the crazed British assassin. And Monauton was excused for his actions because he was unable to appreciate the difference between right and wrong when he tried to assassinate the prime minister. So that's a serious defect of rationality. If you have that, you can get off. Otherwise, you're held responsible regardless of why you acted the way you are. The law doesn't care whether you killed someone because you had an unhappy childhood, you didn't like your mommy and daddy because you ate too many Twinkies. Basically, as long as you were essentially rational, you're held responsible. But say the proponents of this new neuroscience, it makes no sense to hold someone responsible, even if they're able to appreciate the difference between right and wrong, if they're in some sense, unable to control themselves because of some organic defect. They may not be insane in the legal sense, but they may not also be fully able to control themselves because their brains, in some sense, are not fully normal. Now you see already the vexing challenge. Should judges be in the business of deciding what sort of brain is fully normal and at what point people are completely able to control themselves? The most vivid and concrete example of this question in recent years was a Supreme Court case, Roper and Simmons, involving the juvenile death penalty. And the question here was, should juveniles who are 16 and 17 be able to be executed because of their murders, or should they be excused because their brains are not fully developed? Neuroscientists, many of the distinguished ones, submitted briefs to the Supreme Court saying that because the brains of adolescents are not fully myelinated at 16 and 17, they're not fully able to control their actions, and therefore the death penalty should not be imposed. Now, the Supreme Court, in an important opinion written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, the man who's now running the country, as you all know, the swing vote, who's determining all of our fate on questions running from military tribunals to partial birth abortion. Kennedy, in a kind of tip of the hat to the neuroscience brief, cited them. And he said, as any parent knows, and as the scientific briefs cited by Amici confirm, adolescents are not fully able to control their actions. So this was considered the Brown versus Board of Education of neuro law, because he seemed to give some credence to this psychological evidence. Now, Kennedy's opinion was extremely controversial. Skeptics said, this makes no sense. If it's really the brains of adolescents that made them act the way they did, then you'd expect murder rates of adolescents to be the same the world over. But in fact, as Stephen Morse of the University of Pennsylvania, an important neurolaw skeptic, has observed, the murder rates of Danish and Finnish 16 and 17-year-olds are much lower than that of Americans, suggesting that something other than neuroscience is at work. And not to take account of those cross-cultural differences, Morse and other skeptics suggested, was a cavalier use of science. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court seemed to invite this sort of evidence, and we'll no doubt be seeing more and more of it in years to come. Then we get into this really rich philosophical question about the nature of responsibility and even what it means to think of ourselves as intentionally choosing human beings. There are a group of neuroscientists led by Green and Cohn at Princeton and Harvard who cite an interesting example which is familiar to philosophers known as the trolley experiment. The trolley experiment goes like this. You put people under a brain scan and present them with the following hypothetical. There's a train heading down the tracks, and if nothing happens, it'll hit five people and kill them. If you pull a switch, the train will detour onto a sidetrack and kill one person. Presented with this scenario, most people say it's okay to pull the switch because you're saving five people and killing one. By contrast, a second hypothetical involves the same train heading toward the track, and the way that you stop it is to push a fat man, a large man, who's on a footbridge over the train onto the track. He is killed in this terrible accident, and the five people are saved. Presented with this hypothetical, most people say, no, it's not okay to pull the switch. And Green and Cohn put people under a brain scan as they were presented with this hypothetical, and they found that the amygdala, the emotional regions of the brain, activated very strongly during the second hypothetical involving the large man, and not during the first one, suggesting that faced with the possibility of personally killing an identifiable human being under such emotionally wrenching circumstances, people were unable to make the utilitarian calculus that they could do when the scenario is less emotionally inflaming. Green and Cohn took from this combination of the trolley hypothetical and the brain scan evidence broad claims about the future of retribution. They said, these experiments suggest that it's no longer sane to impose the idea of that people should be held accountable for their intentionally chosen immoral behavior. The idea of retribution, that bad people should be punished because they're bad, which at the moment is the centerpiece of American penal goals, rehabilitation having gone out of fashion in the 1960s, retribution, say Green and Cohn, should be jettisoned because the idea of intentional immorality makes no sense in light of this brain evidence. Instead, they say that deterrence is the only sane goal of the criminal justice system. You can lock people up to keep them from committing future bad acts, but it makes no sense to lock them up because they themselves are bad. Now, defense lawyers have hailed this claim for the end of retribution, or forgive me, for the end of imposing people accountable for their immoral behavior as a good thing for defendants. They think lots of convicted criminals will get off if they're not imprisoned because they're bad people. But there have been skeptics to this view. Carter Sneed, my friend who got me excited about this subject to begin with, has said, Green and Cohn are missing something. If really we're just punishing people to prevent them from committing future bad acts, the idea of mitigation, that you should get a lower sentence if you accept responsibility or if there are other factors that put your character in a broader perspective, is out the window, and therefore more people might actually be executed if they're really dangerous under the goal of deterrence. Or we could imagine people being locked up indefinitely just as sex offenders are now locked up under a kind of preventative detention, even after they've served their time, in order to deter them from committing future bad acts. So it's not at all clear that the end of retribution would have purely pro-defense effects. Are Green and Cohn correct about this idea that neuroscience presents a radical challenge to the idea of personhood? Morse, the Pennsylvania skeptic, who I'm much impressed by, says he doesn't buy it yet, although there's one scenario where he can imagine questioning the very idea of human personhood. He cites the fascinating example experiments by Benjamin Libet in the 70s and 80s. Libet put people under brain scans in experiments where they were asked to randomly move their fingers whenever they felt like it, just whenever they felt like moving their fingers, they should do so. And Libet found that the intention to move a finger expressed itself 500 milliseconds, a half a second, before the finger actually moved, and 400 milliseconds before the person became aware of the conscious intention to move the finger, suggesting that there was 100 milliseconds where you could veto the action that the brain, the decision that the brain had already reached. One neuroscientist called this not free will, but free won't. You can decide not to do what the brain has somehow decided to do on its own because it's hardwired to combine various influences in unconscious ways, but you can't actually decide to do anything in an intentional way. And Morse said if those experiments played out a little bit more dramatically, maybe we would have to re-examine the whole idea that we're intentional thinking human beings who have come to this breakfast to talk about neuroscience and the law rather than automatons who are driven here by forces beyond our control. But he's not sold yet. So as you can see, these are deep philosophical questions that really do challenge our notion of personhood at their core.
You're listening to Jeffrey Rosen, a law professor at George Washington University. He spoke at the Aspen Ideas Festival in July about how our legal system might be changed by discoveries in the field of neuroscience. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Now let's talk a little bit more concretely about the very interesting new advances involving lie detection and the detection of hidden bias. Lie detection may be the most concrete way in which neuroscience transforms the law in the not-so-distant future. There are, at the moment, two lie detection technologies which are competing for attention right now. One involves measuring so-called P300 waves in the brain. So, for example, experiments have been done which claim to be able to show someone a picture of a training camp in Afghanistan. If they've been there, then the P300 waves in their brain will emit in a certain pattern, suggesting a familiarity with the scene that they've seen before. If not, then it won't. This could obviously be a spectacular device for identifying terrorists if it were made to work. I gather that most objective observers believe that the P300 technology developed by Lawrence Falwell is not yet ready for prime time. The second technology involves a series of experiments called guilty knowledge, done by a University of Pennsylvania scholar, who puts people in the fMRI, gives them a certain playing card, and then tells them, when they're in the magnet, to lie about whether or not they have it, to say that they don't have it, even though they do. The magnet then looks at the patterns of their brain while they're lying, and based on repeated experiments along these lines, can basically come up with a profile of what the brain looks like when it's lying. And the proponents of this technology say this will be a really effective lie detection technology, even better than polygraphs. Polygraphs right now are at about 80% or 75% accuracy, which is not high enough to satisfy the Supreme Court standards. In the Daubert case, for the reliability of scientific evidence. But the proponents think maybe in 5 years they could get up to 90 or 95%, which would be accurate enough. Now, if this lie detection technology was accurate enough to satisfy the standards for admission to court, we could imagine a whole range of implications for the legal system. Could defense and prosecution witnesses be truth tested, basically have to go into the magnet and prove that you're telling the truth before you can go onto the stand? Could even defendants be truth tested, at least if they're immunized, if they're granted immunity from the results of the test, which might solve any Fifth Amendment problems? All of a sudden, as a law professor, this gets me really going, we're seeing a fundamental challenge to what the basic constitutional protections for against self-incrimination and unreasonable searches and seizures involve. Traditionally, the Supreme Court, in deciding whether or not you have a Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate yourself, has distinguished between physical evidence and testimonial evidence. So I can't refuse to take a blood test if I'm stopped on the road for drunk driving, because my blood is considered physical evidence. I'm not testifying in my own words to anything. My body is just expressing a fact. By contrast, I can't be asked when I'm stopped on the road, are you drunk? Because that would be testimonial. Although it would be pretty obvious if I was weaving and my blood was have high alcohol content, I could be convicted by my blood but not by my words. But is a brain scan physical or testimonial? Do I put out my brain waves the way I put out the trash, which according to the Supreme Court means I have no expectation of privacy in particular bits of evidence? Or is it somehow expressing something at the core of me, my soul, my personhood, in a way that does deserve Fifth Amendment protections? There are no existing answers in the current legal doctrine to questions like this. You can search the case books and search Supreme Court cases all you like, and I assure you these are questions courts have not yet begun to confront, and lawyers can eloquently and convincingly argue them either way. But I do have to say that I'm daunted when I look at the history of Fifth Amendment law and Fourth Amendment law by how thin those amendments provide protection for mental privacy. The core of the original Fifth Amendment was a prohibition against forced oaths. You couldn't summon the Puritans to the Star Chamber in Elizabethan England and asked whether or not they were heretics under oath, because that was considered a form of mental torture. They were faced with a choice between lying and going to hell for perjury or convicting themselves in their own words. But we've come far from that prohibition on oaths, and currently the Fifth Amendment provides almost no protection for private diaries. We learned during the Ken Starr investigation a couple of years ago that it's possible for prosecutors to subpoena Monica Lewinsky's diary, where she'd written her love letters to the president, even though at the time of the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, when it was passed at the early, in the late 1800s, that was considered the paradigmatic example of an unreasonable search. But over the course of the past 200 years, those substantive protections for private diaries, for mental privacy, have been whittled away. So nowadays, the bottom line is there's not much of them left. This is why I want to issue a caution that it would be wrong to rely on the courts to solve these vexing problems involving the future of cognitive liberty, as some have called it. And some have said that we need a new conception of cognitive liberty to respond to the challenges posed by these new technologies. Cognitive liberty will also be implicated by questions involving the detection of hidden bias. There are interesting experiments involving people's response to unfamiliar faces. And a test called the implicit association test has found that when presented with unfamiliar African-American and white faces, white experimenters or white students in these experiments will have a higher amygdala response, a higher mistrustful fight or flight response to unfamiliar black faces than unfamiliar white faces, although they don't have the same response to familiar African-American faces. Tiger Woods and Colin Powell do not produce the same response. This has suggested to the researchers that really we all harbor unconscious bias, and when these experiments are combined with brain scans and the amygdala and prefrontal cortex activity is combined, proponents of this say this is going to transform jury selection. We should put everyone in the scanner before sitting on a jury, and the prejudiced people can be instantly struck, and only those of us who are pure can survive. According to these tests, there'll be no jurors, actually, because none of us is pure. But this, too, presents deep questions of mental privacy and bias, as well as equality and equal protection, that I'm just struck by the fact that the current law has little to say, and we have to do some long and hard thinking about all this. The final area that I want to talk to you about, and then I want to get your thoughts on all of these vexing questions, is the prediction of future criminal behavior. This really is the stuff of Minority Report and Tom Cruise movies. Is it possible, by scanning someone's brain, to figure out whether their brain will predispose them to commit future bad acts, whether or not they know it? The history of efforts to predict future bad criminal behavior based on organic brain differences is disreputable and sobering. The Italian criminologist Lombroso came up with an elaborate schema for various criminals based on phrenological characteristics of their brain. He claimed, by feeling the lumps on someone's head, to be able to decide who was likely to commit what kinds of crimes. 19th century criminologists in London had elaborate card files measuring the faces, the noses, the ears, the eye ratios of convicted criminals, and promising the police would be able, with a touch of a card file, to be able to figure out who was going to commit bad crimes in the future. This has a disreputable history, which culminated in the eugenics movement, the so-called movement devoted to the science of better breeding, which led in America, initially, at the turn of the century, to a series of laws mandating the sterilization of so-called imbeciles and mental defectives. And lest we think that these were archaic laws that were just adopted by a fringe, they were adopted by a majority of states. They were upheld by the Supreme Court in an infamous opinion by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, which famously said, "It is better for all the world," which, instead of allowing degenerate races to continue to propagate themselves, they should be stopped in their tracks. He said, "Three generations of imbeciles is enough." And Holmes, who was thought of as a progressive, was not alone here. Teddy Roosevelt was an enthusiastic eugenicist, and the major religious denominations, Christian, Protestant, and Jewish. The more liberal sects were enthusiastically pro-eugenics. They couldn't get enough of it. It was only the more conservative sects, especially the conservative Catholics, who opposed it. And the only dissenter from that Supreme Court case, Buck and Bell, was the only conservative Catholic on the court. So let's not fool ourselves for a moment to think that we well-intentioned, pro-technology, right-thinking people are immune from the enthusiasms of previous generations. History has a way of rebuking us of that belief. What could neuroscience do that might raise the specter of phrenology and eugenics on the one hand, or perhaps protect us in useful ways during an anxious time of terror in another? Adrian Raine, a neuroscientist at USC, has studied the organic brain material of convicted murderers, and he claims that there's higher metabolism in the brains of convicted murderers and 11% less gray matter in the prefrontal cortex of people with antisocial personality disorder, which has a high correlation with violence. It's not a huge step from this claim to imagine scanning suspected terrorists, asking whether or not they have the spot that predisposes them to future violence, and then maybe not locking them up in jail, but detaining them preventatively as enemy combatants or as potentially dangerous offenders for a long time. I don't know about you, but this really gets my... This makes me shudder. One of the most basic precepts of Anglo-American jurisprudence, indeed something my mom told me when I was young and has always stuck in my mind, is you're not responsible for what you think, only for what you do. The idea that you should be held accountable only for your intentional actions, not for your thoughts, is the centerpiece of a liberal society. But this idea of preventative detention on the basis of your predispositions and thoughts challenges that notion at its core. Would existing constitutional doctrine protect us against preventative detention for people based on the spots in their brain? It won't. It's really remarkable when you just scan the amendments to the Constitution, the ones that you'd think would protect us against these things, they don't. The Fourth and Fifth Amendment, you could say it's an unreasonable search of the brain, but the brain waves might not be considered private, like our houses. We've discussed the thinness of the Fifth Amendment protections. Maybe it's cruel and unusual punishment that violates the Eighth Amendment to detain people based on their future predispositions. But if a lot of states pass these laws or if the federal government embraces it, the Eighth Amendment really just counts up how unusual the punishment is, and that wouldn't provide very substantive protection. Interestingly, those eugenics laws at the turn of the century were challenged on Eighth Amendment grounds, and most of those challenges failed, especially after the things became more and more popular. The best constitutional argument I can come up with against indefinite detention based on future predispositions is a very esoteric one, which is not likely to convince a court. It's more of an analogy than a legal argument. There's a constitutional provision prohibiting bills of attainder. Bills of attainder were ancient English indignities where if I'm a traitor against the king, I commit seditious libel or treason, then not only am I sentenced to death, but my blood is attaint, and all of my heirs, all Rosens until time immemorial, shall be banished, they shall be degraded, they will be strangers to the law, and they'll be unable to participate in civil society. Bills of attainder were met with this very gruesome series of demeaning punishments where people were slowly and ceremonially disemboweled and their various body parts were cut up in very exquisite ritualistic ways. It was a shaming punishment meant to degrade and completely banish from respectable society people who are considered strangers to the law. There is something, maybe you're not convinced, but it seems to me an idea of the attaint about the idea that even before you've done something, you should be banished from civil society and basically unable to have legal recourse and to exert yourself as a citizen. But that's, would I expect a court to buy that? Absolutely not, because it's an analogy, but it's not concrete enough to be the kind of thing that courts could really put their teeth into. And that's why the note that I want to end on as we... now begin our discussion together, is a caution against too much confidence in the salvation of courts. When I look at the history of the privacy debates over the course of the 19th and 20th century, I'm struck by how little salvation has come from the courts and how much from the political system. So this is not a pessimistic caution, an optimistic one, but it's a caution nevertheless. Lie detector tests, polygraphs, which are quite unreliable. There was a time in the 60s when employers were crazy for them. They were considered the new thing, and everyone was to be polygraphed before they got a job. An important book by Alan Weston about privacy denounced the accuracy of polygraphs. Activists on both sides of the political spectrum rose up, and as a result of that, laws were passed prohibiting polygraphs because of their unreliability. That was a political victory. It was not a legal victory. When we think about the history of freedom of conscience, there are a few bright spots, the court's response to the McCarthyite threat in the 1950s, but courts are malleable, and no sooner did the court try to protect people against congressional investigations into their conscience than Congress threatened the court, and the court backed away. By the 1960s, many of those privacy decisions had been overturned or watered down. We see this again and again. The courts, when it comes to privacy and the nature of the human consciousness, tend to mirror public opinion rather than thwarting it in sustained ways, and that's why it would be folly to rely on judges as our salvation. On the other hand, discussion, activism, this is not a partisan issue. There's an unusual bipartisan coalition of civil libertarian liberals and libertarian conservatives that care about these issues. They were the ones who rose up to oppose some of the more questionable aspects of the USA Patriot Act. They've actually been fairly effective in quiet but intense ways. And what I think we can do as a society, and we can actually begin here, these issues are very complicated. They're technically and scientifically complicated. They're legally complicated. But there's no need to leave them to the experts. By beginning a conversation, and I'm not saying this in a banal, touchy-feely way. I think it's an urgent need. That conversation will eventually filter into a political system. It will provoke responses on both sides of the political system and eventually will be reflected in laws. Neuroscience alone cannot tell us the mystic point at which someone should be excused from responsibility because they're not responsible in some deep sense, because they're not able to control themselves. That is a moral and legal, but ultimately a political question, and we as a society have to answer it ourselves. Thank you so much.
Jeffrey Rosen is a professor at George Washington University Law School and legal affairs editor for The New Republic magazine. He spoke July 7th at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Colorado about how advances in neuroscience and technology might change the legal system. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pancava. After his speech, Jeffrey Rosen took questions from the audience in Aspen.
As we look at global literature and data in the medical world, we see some varieties in other countries. Are you seeing a shift globally in this concept?
This is a wonderful question. It's absolutely central to the whole debate. There are tremendous differences culturally. The Supreme Court in that Roper case, said that there was an international consensus about the juvenile death penalty. I found that an even more unconvincing part of the decision than the use of neuroscience evidence. Because for me, as someone who's interested in the comparative response of different countries to privacy, the differences are much more illuminating than the similarities. So, for example, Europeans care much more about dignity and about the ability to keep your data concealed from the private sector, whereas Americans care much more about liberty and the ability not to have government spy on you and your home. And that reflects a totally different attitude toward hierarchy. The Europeans have a history of knowing where they stand, so that if you're insulted by someone below you on the social scale, you respond in a different way than if an aristocrat insults you. This is foreign to America, because we have a much more egalitarian history. And this, yes, is reflected in different laws. The English have a very different attitude toward restrictions on stem cell research than we do. They're also more deferential to experts than we are, which is good for them in this area because, you know, we have at the at this Ideas Festival, all the great neuroscience experts are here. Many of them have applied to the MacArthur Foundation for a grant to help experts on in neuroscience and law talk together about appropriate solutions. If that goes ahead, they hope that they'll be able to come up with good solutions. But if Americans are not deferential to experts and prefer to figure it all out themselves, then they're unlikely to defer to that and also unlikely to learn from the experience of foreign countries. So I think if that project goes forward, I think your question, which is simply to compare how, not Europe in the abstract, but France, which is different than Germany, which is different than Britain, which is different than Spain, responds, how that reflects the culture of each country and the legal system, I think this could teach us a great deal. So for me, the differences are more important than the similarities, and you're right to call our attention to that.
Thank you. Over here.
How is what you have shared affecting the position for or against the death penalty?
My sense is that it hasn't yet filtered into the public consciousness. So the big effect on attitudes toward the death penalty came about through DNA evidence, and all of the actual innocence that was discovered in the 90s did affect the polls and caused states like Illinois to shift. This neuroscience thing is too inchoate, and I don't think it hasn't been on TV yet, although some of the Law and Order and some of the big shows are now working up episodes on it, so slowly it'll work itself into the popular culture. But based on the best evidence we have, which is jurors in actual death penalty cases, they do not seem to be consistently persuaded. In a couple cases, jurors have given people life rather than death. A Florida court has held it reversible error not to admit the evidence, and in that Spider Siskov, and here's one other famous case in the 1990s, which got the whole thing going. A guy threw his wife out of a 12-story window on 72nd Street in Manhattan. He claimed that his brain made him do it. He showed a brain scan that showed that he had an arachnoid cyst, which surrounded his brain like a spider web. The judge said the jury could see evidence that he had the cyst, but not that it was associated with violence. But the prosecution was afraid enough that it would sway the jury that they copped a plea and he pled to a lower penalty. So all this suggests that it's coming in. Jurors are skeptical. But here's the final thought I have in response to your good question. Neuroscientists fear that the pictures are so bright and alluring that jurors eventually, and society as a whole, will give them too much weight. If you see a sexy picture of someone's brain, or at least a bright picture with pretty colors, they'll think that it's much more reliable than if someone testifies about it in words. And because we tend to be swayed by images, it might be given too much weight.
Yes.
Since in many jurisdictions, sentencing is in the province of the judge, where does this come in to play? We know, of course, that judges have a record of harshness or leniency in convictions, but could a judge be asked to take a test by a defense lawyer?
Oh, my goodness. Very good. Yes, imagine the motions from the Bush administration, the Libby trial, before that one began. Judge Walton, step into the scanner. We just want to make sure that you... Absolutely, and indeed that my friends at Vanderbilt were excited about the possibility that judges might have to be scanned, and that could completely transform the way we think about neutral ideals of justice and the idea that justice is blind. Remember Chief Justice Roberts used to, in his confirmation hearings, talked about judges wear black robes because no one cares what the umpire thinks. When the umpire goes into a brain scan, you care a whole lot what they think. And the sentencing guidelines themselves might be called into question. Jones at Vanderbilt says, if it turns out that there's a huge gap between most people's intuitive sense of how much punishment a particular crime should get in a hypothetical scenario and what the sentencing guidelines allow, then they should be reformed based on the idea that that law shouldn't diverge too strongly from people's social intuition. So like the previous question, that's another good reminder that even if we can do these experiments, do we want to do them, or does the law rest on certain fictions and opacity that would be challenged at its core by this new technology?
There recently was a very troubling case in a small town in Massachusetts where a child with autism was violent towards another child, and the town went up in arms, and essentially a lot of the community said autistic children are more prone to violence because of their brain structure. And I'm curious if, you know, most of the cases that have been in the law have been individuals saying, you know, insanity defense or violence defense based on being an individual. I'm curious if there's been, any conversation about groups of individuals with certain special needs or conditions.
Very interesting. There are people here who know more about this than I do. Mike Gazzaniga, do you know of any group cases?
It's mostly an argument, and so people take particular examples, the famous one in history being Phineas Gage, who had a iron driven through his frontal lobes, and he had a disinhibited behavior and violent behavior and so forth. And people cite that kind of thing. But the problem with it all is that if you look at the kind of lesion that Phineas Gage had, and then you look more generally in the neurologic community, do you see that lesion elsewhere and in people who are not acting violently? The answer is a big fat yes. So how can you use this kind of data to make exculpable someone who happens to have a lesion and happens to have created committed a crime or created havoc somewhere? That's, to me, the central question and dilemma, the thing that neuroscience has got to sort out.
That puts it very nicely. And as you can see from Mike's answer, not only do people with the same brain structures behave in different ways, but it's not clear that the group-based claim would always be used for liberal means. You could try to say people, autistic kids should be treated differently or excused from responsibility because of a predisposition in the brain, but they might also be subject to disabilities or that sort of predictive, preventative detention for the same reason. So it cuts in many complicated directions, but I think the answer now, I'm more confident of it, is that the group-based claims haven't yet been raised in a very sustained way. Perhaps they will be.
Has there been any conversation or consideration of at what point, if this is accepted science, at what point would a test be triggered, for example, and also how it might dovetail with therapy? As you know, there's a whole line of cases about, you know, whether or not a therapist should have known that a patient was violent, short of them saying, I want to go out and, you know, kill my ex-girlfriend, and how those two things might dovetail. This just came up in this case of this kid at Virginia Tech who shot all these people. Should people have been able to predict this, and how would this test be incorporated into those questions?
Wow, that is a whole other dizzying series of hypotheticals. We know from Virginia Tech that the schools are already on tenterhooks because of fear of legal liability and feel compelled to take all sorts of ineffective or intrusive action to prevent future Virginia Techs, even though this sort of thing may be impossible to predict. You're suggesting at what point should kids, for example, have to take brain scans, or should potential terrorists have to take brain scans? Maybe you could imagine broad surveillance technology where all citizens at airports have their data scanned. You look for unusual patterns, or all kids have their consumer data stand in school to see their magazine subscriptions or their television watching habits to see if they're antisocial. After a certain degree of probable cause or reasonable suspicion exists, then you target particular individuals to have them brain scanned and then lock them up forever. Another deep Fourth Amendment question. Then you ask, what about therapeutic justice? To what degree should authorities, whether therapists or schools, be held responsible for not detecting this bad behavior in the first place? Which raises the question of, can this neuroscience technology itself be used to repair broken brains? There's a technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation that claims to be able to suppress and inhibit or activate different parts of the brain. And there's a patent pending for being able to suppress a part of the brain and make someone less likely to lie. If you really view the brain not as the center of a freely choosing actor, but as nothing more like a broken leg if you've got a diseased brain, should brain imaging technologies and brain interventions be compulsory to fix these kids who are predisposed to violence and make them saner? And all of a sudden, we're really talking about a challenge to the core of what personhood involves. So let's put that series of questions on the table, too, for ones that we're not going to solve for a long time. Very slippery slope.
Thank you. Well, we have time for a couple more questions here.
I guess the question is, do you think differently in the civil commitment area? Sort of going back to Bazelon in the, you know, 60s and early 70s. With respect to predictions of dangerousness as to whether someone is dangerous to themselves or others, now that we have more evidence about organic mental illness, structural organic illness and the like.
I'm glad you asked that, and that's another vexing series of debates. You refer to Judge Bazelon, the liberal judge on the D.C. Circuit in the 1960s, who debated when people should be excused from responsibility because of insanity and when they should be civilly committed. And I'm concerned about this possibility that people might be preventatively detained based on organic brain defects, mostly because the Supreme Court has been so uninterested in imposing limits on civil commitments. In the sexual offender cases, it's basically said even after you've served your time as a sex offender, you can still be locked up indefinitely because the punishment is not intended to punish. It's not punitive and therefore isn't in the criminal system. It's designed to keep you off the streets and therefore is civil. The court has upheld all sorts of things from the John internet sites, which embarrass people who go to prostitutes, to actual incarceration of sex offenders. You're right that we know much more about organic brain defects, but perhaps not so much to know who will actually misbehave in the future and who not. And in an age when terrorists are being preventatively detained forever as enemy combatants without any recourse to the law, that's another series of challenges about whether we'd want citizens to be preventatively detained forever based on future dangerousness.
We have time for one more question.
With respect to the P waves, have any studies been done, say, with respect to the polygraph, how, you know, a neurotic person can, you know, mess up a polygraph? Couldn't that same person do the same thing with a P wave?
It's true. The polygraphs have been proven to be too unreliable for government work for admission because it's possible to intentionally mess them up. And yes, the same thing could be done with the P waves. So you're a terrorist. You've been to the training camp in Afghanistan, and you're shown a picture of the training camp in Afghanistan, but instead you're thinking really, really hard of, I don't know, your vacation house in Maine or something. You're basically messing up the picture by imagining something else. And it's possible to imagine through discipline ways of messing up the system so they're less than reliable. I do have to stress, it's my understanding that the P300 waves aren't yet much beyond the polygraph in terms of accuracy, so they won't be being introduced anytime soon. But it's a good note on which to end because you've reminded us that no technology is infallible. Each scientific advance can be met with some sort of counter, and we shouldn't for a moment imagine that our machines will solve us from all of these vexing and fascinating moral and political questions we've discussed today. Thank you so much for a great discussion.
Jeffrey Rosen is the legal affairs editor for The New Republic magazine and a professor of law at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He spoke July 7th at the Aspen Ideas Festival about how discoveries by neuroscientists into our brain's workings could affect law and courtroom cases. If you missed some of today's speech by Jeffrey Rosen, or if you would just like to hear it again, our website, wordforword.org, is the place to go. There, you may hear this week's show, subscribe to our free weekly podcast, and listen to any of our previous programs, including sessions with Karl Rove, Norman Mailer, former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and Justice Stephen Breyer. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert and Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.